Conoco Minolta versus, EEOC versus Conoco Minolta. Mr. Patton?
Morning, Your Honors. This court should reverse the district court's enforcement of the EEOC's subpoena because the district court's factual determinations are clearly erroneous. The EEOC is pushing past the boundaries of Section 709 of Title VII, and no case that the EEOC cites has allowed the EEOC to subpoena aggregate hiring information based on a single plaintiff terms and conditions discipline discharge case.
Why doesn't the information that the EEOC was looking for cast some light on the terms and conditions complaint that was filed by Mr. Thompson?
Your Honor, I look to the United Airlines case.
But that case was much broader in the sense that worldwide data about what United Airlines does with its employees elsewhere goes very substantially beyond any obligation that does or does not apply to contributing to the French social security system. So I have no problem with the concept that some subpoenas are too broad. Of course, some subpoenas are too broad. But this one, it seems to me, was designed to cast some light on the particular complaint that Mr. Thompson. It wasn't other cities. It wasn't, you know, lots of things.
The way I read United is that they sought other comparable information for other benefits other than the Social Security issue between French and Americans. And the and this court said, no, you're not going to get that because the benefits information that was alleged in the charge was systemic. Here we have no evidence in there's nothing in Mr. Thompson's charge that says that he was subjected to systemic discrimination.
Well, I'm not sure that's giving the EEOC or Mr. Thompson proper credit. It's a typical pro se kind of charge. He complains about terms and conditions, and that's really about all we have. But the EEOC begins to see a picture that maybe he wasn't fired because he was doing a bad job. Maybe there was racial discrimination going on. Nobody knows that yet. I mean, and I don't want to get ahead of anything here, but they feel that trying to see who's entering the pipeline might help them determine whether, in the final analysis, his experience was one that was attributable to perfectly legitimate business decisions on your client's part versus discrimination. And the standard that the courts have used, the Shell Oil case in particular, is information that might cast light on. It's at least as generous as Rule 26, maybe more so.
Your Honor, I just don't see it because the charge, he was actually hired by Minolta.
Well, you're focusing on this hiring versus, if we actually got to the point of summary judgment, sure, hiring versus terms and conditions or firing are different claims, but the commission is investigating up front, before anything has happened. Right?
Correct. And I think they are constrained by Section 709A.
Yeah, everybody agrees with that. The only question is whether this subpoena goes beyond it.
Well, and it does, and I think if you look at the supplemental authority cited by the EEOC, the Kronos litigation, you see another application of 709A, and as Your Honor was saying, the EEOC is getting into this, and they see something they're concerned about. That happened strikingly in the Kronos litigation, where the EEOC found an article by the respondent's former test designer, in which he said the test that I designed that they used to apply for people applying for employment at Kroger is discriminatory.
But you would agree, I'm sure, that there's some line drawing that has to go on between an event where the EEOC finds a completely different violation, and so maybe a commissioner's charge is necessary, maybe they just have to drop it, whatever, and something where something that's a bit outside the scope of the core complaint but that throws light on how would you go about proving that core complaint has happened. And courts have given a lot of deference to the EEOC's assessment of which side of that line things fall on. I'm looking at Mr. Thompson's complaint. He does complain about different terms and conditions of employment. He says he was disciplined where a non-black wasn't disciplined. He complains. He's discharged. And so the EEOC is trying to get to the bottom of that complaint. And they think one, maybe it's a slightly circuitous route, but they've made the case that one route is through this information.
Most of the language that supports the breadth, and I would agree that the standard is a generous standard to the EEOC, but here they're going too far. But most of that original language in the Bluebell Boots, the Roadway Express cases, those actually came in cases in the earlier generation of Title VII when respondents were not even giving up comparable evidence in discharge cases of other employees who were not disciplined or not discharged.
But the Supreme Court's never backed off the Shell Oil standard.
No, it has not, but it, you're right, there is a point where it becomes a nullity, and
sure.
I think if you look at the cases, it seems to me that the point is the charge either needs to allege, in this case it would need to allege hiring, or would need to allege something systemic.
Why? Because you think hiring evidence can never build into evidence that would help somebody prove whether an experience on the job was, I mean, think of even Rule 26 standard, evidence that might lead to admissible evidence, and the, as I said, the EEOC can't be any worse off than Rule 26.
Well, I think
they may be better off.
I think that's an idle hope. I mean, that's just our position, that hiring discrimination is separate from discharge that's not alleged to be systemic or anything like that. There have been other cases where, for example, in the Jocelyn Dry Goods, where somebody worked for an employer, was terminated, her charge alleged termination, but she also put in there something about that the respondent was discriminating against people in hiring. So there are ways that can be addressed, the vehicle from the charge. It's not here. And the EEOC is concerned about that, and that's why they've constructed this argument that I think resulted in the ruling in the district court. They've constructed this argument that the subpoenaed information goes to the teams and territory issue, and quite simply it does not. The information subpoenaed does not relate to team and territory.
Well, why should
assignment.
We take your view of that as opposed to the commission's?
Well, I'm saying that the way I read their brief, they have two arguments, and that is that the subpoena goes to teams and territories, and that's what makes it relevant to Mr. Thompson's terms and conditions, and the subpoena doesn't go to teams and territories, and that's another place where the district court made an erroneous finding of fact. Their other argument is...
But do you think teams and territories aren't part of the terms and conditions of employment?
Well, if the argument is that the way I read the EEOC's response brief, that they're alleging segregation, or they're saying that they think Mr. Thompson, he never has amended his charge or anything to put that in there, but it's the EEOC's theory, that's segregation. And segregation is a different provision of Title VII than terms and conditions of employment. Terms and conditions of employment.
But we've had a lot of cases that say when we're actually evaluating a charge, we don't assume, you know, that a lawyer of your quality has drafted it. These are people who are, you know, telling their story. We don't hold them to those legal niceties.
And he's been the EEOC has access to him, and in other cases in base shipbuilding, the charge was amended with the charging party to allege hiring discrimination.
Why do they need to do that, though, if he's not charging hiring discrimination? He was hired.
He's charging that
he was treated differently while he was working there, and the EEOC is trying to figure out how to prove that or how to ascertain whether it's a charge worthy of going forward on.
And I think that goes They had their territory and team argument, and then that goes to their argument that really does blow past 709A, and that is this investigatory relevance, which they claim will help them focus the investigation. And that standard is just a way beyond 709A, because anything can arguably help them focus their investigation or help them out get their feet on the ground.
But suppose they had asked for every city, you know, that your client works in. That strikes me as, you know, arguably way beyond the scope of this complaint. This guy's only working in the Chicago area. So I don't know that this slippery slope argument is necessarily the way the law would be construed. You know, give them an inch and they'll take a mile is essentially your position.
They haven't gone to this level yet. Now they're trying to go to this level. And if there was a rule that says alleged terms and conditions of employment in a charge and you can get anything under the Title VII for that, then that would be a striking ruling indeed. It's a concern. But I don't think the erroneous rulings of the judge should be overlooked, and I think that is the key because you are supposed to look at the charge, and that was not correctly described in the order, and you have to look at the subpoena, and that was not correctly described in the order. And again, I think that United Airlines is the proper framework. Benefits discrimination on a systemic level with respect to the Social Security payments, that's all that this court allowed the EEOC to get. It didn't allow them to compare French and Americans with other benefits. And I think that's the way the EEOC explains their attempt to get the subpoena here, and maybe Your Honor's questions are addressed to that. Mm-hmm. If someone is discriminating against Americans with respect to one form of benefits, wouldn't it help the EEOC to get information showing that they were discriminating or how they were treating them with respect to other benefits other than the Social Security? And this court said no. So I think that's on point here. And I would mention that another circuit, when the EEOC took the position that it was basically entitled, and I think this is their position here when you get down to the bottom of it, the EEOC is entitled to whatever information they at their discretion think is relevant. The Sixth Circuit did say that is not the standard, and I think it is appropriate to deny enforcement of the subpoena on that basis. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for...
Thank you, Spat. Mr. Harrington?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eric Harrington. I'm here on behalf of the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. I think Hanukkah's view is that we know the end of the story here. We believe we know the end of the story, that Konica has four sales offices in Chicago, and they have six African-American salespeople out of 120. And all six of them are at one location, and all six of them are on one team in one location, and they serve primarily the black community, and the non-black team serves primarily the white community.
Does that violate Title VII to hire black salesmen to sell to primarily black areas?
Not necessarily. There may be a non-discriminatory reason for that, but it also may. But the charge here is that one of those six has alleged that Konica discriminated against him in his terms and condition of employment, which he said started from his very first day on March 1st, 2005.
Mr. Harrington, could I ask you whether the record reflects whether the EEOC was proceeding to any particular degree on the basis of interviews with Mr. Thompson or efforts to flesh out his charge?
I do not think that the interviews that we conducted with Mr. Thompson or the discussions that we had with Mr. Thompson are in the record. I think Your Honor
is the fact of such discussions. I mean, I guess you would ordinarily do that, but I just wondered.
As Your Honor well knows, we would absolutely ordinarily do that, and that was in our lower court briefing that we had discussed with him, and he further fleshed out these charges. That is not in this court's record, which is why we're not arguing about it in our briefing to this court. And I think all of Konica's allegations about what the district court concluded stems from that issue that you're pointing out.
Mr. Harrington, I have a threshold concern about whether or not we can be comfortable that there was a de novo review by the district court of the magistrate's report. As I read the order, the only paragraph that speaks to what I would say the comfort level we would need to feel that the district judge under 72, you know, Rule 72, is this reference to justifying, I'm sure you're familiar with this sentence, but I want to just start with it. This is directly related to Mr. Thompson's contention that he was assigned to a sales team and sales territory based on his race and thus not treated like white salespersons. Now, I think I understand how you want us to extrapolate from there. But if that's the only statement relating to referencing the justification for adopting the report, and it appears to be, at least one could argue, based on a misread of the charge, do we have a hurdle here on review at this stage that we can be comfortable a district judge carried out the function that's required? I mean, this is Article 3, Article 1 territory, and I cannot find too much more in that order before we get to relevance if the judge is focused on a charge not originally in the complaint, and is she looking at relevance through that prism? So I guess you can see where.
I don't think this presents a problem for this court for a few reasons. Number one, the district court adopted in whole the magistrate's report. So any concerns about what was concluded in the district court order, the magistrate's order is incumbent.
If that's the case, then we would never require anything more than one line.
Right.
Right? I mean, you're not arguing that courts of appeals should just call upon one single statement from a United States district court judge saying, I adopt the report in whole?
Well, I think as a matter of course, this court would review what the actual magistrate's opinion is. But I think it doesn't matter for a more.
Let's say you can do that. Let's just say that that's the practice that's evolved over time. But if there's a statement contained in a minimalist order, which seems to suggest, as I say, looking at the case through perhaps a skewed or not accurate reflection of what the complaint is, should there be any disquieting concern expressed or, in fact, precluding an examination beyond what we have? Should this be a case where there has to be a little further exposition of the magistrate's adoption?
Well, let me put it this way. This is my second reason. Even if this court conducted de novo review, the subpoena should still be enforced. That is, if this court looks at the charge in the subpoena and then the extra facts, it's clear that this subpoena, the information sought in the subpoena, would cast light on the charge. And as I think Judge Wood point out, even if there wasn't the terms and condition, which is the only charge that created any problem here with the district court orders, even if this charge alleged only termination, the fact how and why Konica has developed this segregated workforce would tell us a lot about whether racial discrimination was a factor in Mr. Thompson's termination. So just the termination alone.
Following up on what Judge Cuddy said, you would be asking questions like, for example, whether or not black salespersons would prefer to be in a black territory because of the potential for increased sales. I mean, you would make that kind of inquiry. Is that what you're saying?
Meaning in a request for information or just inquiry?
To assess that there isn't a deliberate segregation by the company, but in fact perhaps arises from the employee base, you're suggesting EEOC's investigation and the need for the sweep of this relevance issue would be such that you would ask that kind of question, right?
Absolutely, and it's important to sort of, the EEOC wears a few hats in our scheme of enforcement. At the first stage, at this stage, we're just investigators, and our job is to figure out what's happening. And in fact, before we ever got to enforcement, is to conciliate. And our main charge.
So you have at the end of this process, you could even just say, "We're dropping the whole thing. Here's your right to sue letter."
Absolutely. And so then the question only here is, will the information we seek help us figure out the story? We know how the story ends. The information that we're seeking, what happens from a person who applies all the way through to how they get to be one of the six African Americans in Tinley Park. That will tell us about Mr. Thompson's allegation. And at this stage, we're just trying to figure out what the story is.
EEOC always respond to any charge of this nature if there was a concentration by race of would that alone be enough to cause an investigation? In other words, there's a disproportionate number of Hispanic salespersons in the Southwest for a company that's a nationwide company.
I wouldn't say always, but I would think that given that if in that case we had a charge of discrimination and we had reason to believe that there was a bigger picture of discrimination, then it would obviously make sense for us to start looking into that.
I guess what would be the limits?
So these are the limits, and I think these are the limits that are in the case law, and Judge Wood pointed out one. One limit would be geography. If we requested a subpoena for the hiring data in Los Angeles in this case, that might not make sense. If we had an additional fact, let's say the person who did the hiring system in Chicago is the same person in Los Angeles, now it might cast light. So geography is going to be one, and I think
So you're conceding one of Mr. Patton's main points as well, that when you're doing this kind of investigation, it's got to be tethered to the complaint that was filed by the person whose case you are now looking at. So in this case, Mr. Thompson's complaint. So we have to find some way in which this hiring data is relevant to Mr. Thompson's assertion that he experienced discrimination in terms and conditions of employment.
That is absolutely right.
So this is not just if we ask for it, we get it.
No, and they're trying to sort of put that position on us. That is not our position. Our position is what Shell Oil and its progeny makes clear is we have vast authority, but it still must be relevant to the charge. But the relevancy standard is very broad. So if it'll cast light on the charge, then we, as the Supreme Court said in Shell Oil, we have access to virtually any information that might cast light on the charge.
So
that's our limitation.
And you think cast light is a broader standard than Rule 26?
You know,
it would make some sense of this.
It hadn't come up, and I was thinking about this while you were asking the questions, and I think it certainly would, because at the very least, and is in the Fourth Circuit and Ninth Circuit cases discussing the investigatory standard, that might not lead to admissible evidence, but in those kind of cases. So I think it's at least that, but it's probably a bit broader.
Okay.
If the Court has no further questions,
no,
we'll
I guess not. Thank you,
thank
Mr. Honor. Mr. Patton?
Well, I think that the parties are in agreement that this court can conduct a de novo review of the district court's findings, and so that's one thing we're in agreement about. I would note that the provisions of 709A and keeping the EEOC constrained is very important. We've already, Conica has already spent years responding to multiple requests from the EEOC for information, and so it does impact how we run our business. If the court were to find that the terms and use of terms, just the boilerplate terms and conditions, along with a discipline and discharge charge of discrimination, can get them aggregate hiring data, whether it's regional or nationwide, that would indeed be a significant ruling, and I think the wrong ruling, because there's nothing in the subpoena that seeks the information that the UC talks so much about in their briefs, and that is the team assignment and territory assignment issue, and because it would, I think, basically give them limitless ability to open up investigations as long as they stay within the same statute, and it would be very problematic, and I think they would do a lot of spinning of wheels, as they have in this case, because we've been here for a number of years and we haven't progressed. And we have given them hiring data. They do have that. They're seeking much more, and it's not appropriate. I would just say one thing on the burdensomeness issue and point out that in United Airlines, the Seventh Circuit made clear that it's not the disrupt the normal operations of business. It's the sliding scale, and I think it's appropriate that we're here. There's minimal relevance that the burdensome argument goes to Minolta. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Patton. Thank you, Mr. Harrington. The case is taken under advisement.